Is that why you hit your wife? Withdrawn? Is that why you drink and pop pills? Withdrawn? Are you a virgin? Withdrawn.
Says here you robbed a hospital. Why'd you do that?
Yeah, I'm not guilty.
That's not what the other lawyer said.
Actually, I was going to stay in my office tonight and work on my law blog.
Of course, the blah 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 law blog. Wow, you, sir, are a mouthful.
The jury is instructed to disregard its own testimony.
Your Honor, the prosecution rests.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 110. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is your other host, Andrew Torres. How are you doing, Andrew?
I'm fantastic. How are you, Thomas?
Totally fine. Everything's exactly normal as can be. Yeah. So let's just
Nothing happened at all
with our regular show that we do that is awesome week in, week out. I'm just going to get back to the comfort of our scholarly legal, you know, insightful show.
I love doing this show so much. Yeah. I mean, I just did two live shows in Austin and Salt Lake City, and I met a bunch of OA fans, and it was just fantastic. It was, it was really,
that
really
sounds
great.
That sounds really fun.
It was so fun.
That sounds I wish I could do something like that sometime.
Yeah. And coming up, it's a week from when this episode drops, is PastaCon in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I am trying to get free to go there. A lot of our friends are going to be there. Callie Wright is one of the featured speakers. It should be a great time. I have links for tickets up on my Facebook page. I'm not affiliated at all with the show, but yeah, it's, you know, like, I think it's important for us to support skeptic conferences that don't suck.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Well, okay, so we'll talk about that. Maybe I should say, it's short notice, but maybe I could try to go to that. Yeah, all right. Let's get to what is always an excellent show. It's our current events Friday. It's our rapid response team Friday. And we're going to talk about lots of stuff. We've got gun control. So, you know, that's in the news. Really, really sad news that happened on, I think, Sunday night. Absolutely devastating. We're going to talk about gun control and what we can and can't do in the wake of DC v. Heller. And we're also going to talk about Clears Kushner. We've got our yodeling segment. We're on Yodel Mountain today, and I think it might actually be Clears Kushner. Is that right? We'll have to get
to it. You're going to have to listen and find out.
And then finally, Andrew, do I have this right? Are there two yodels in today's episode? There's another yodel.
Yeah, stereo yodeling today.
What happened was, after the yodeling of the first segment, the people clamored for an encore. They clamored for an encore. Our yodeler came back. He said, you know what? I got to go back out there. Went back on Yodel Mountain. And we're doing another yodel segment. So we've got two yodel segments. The second one is Donald Trump Jr. and Ivanka. Were they nearly indicted in 2012? So we'll find out about that. In the meantime, we also need to talk about Andrew Seidel is going to be on Tuesday. Really excited.
Oh, yeah, me too. Andrew Seidel from the Freedom From Religion Foundation. He came on, did a fantastic interview, and then stuck around and did like another hour and a half that we turned into another show. Just a great guest, really smart lawyer. And he thinks that I'm wrong about some things. So I'm going to gently persuade him that he's wrong about that.
Now, does he have any qualifications, or is he just a person who has internet access? Is what level of debate?
Yeah, no, he is a practicing attorney with the Freedom From Religion Foundation who works in the kinds of First Amendment cases that I only opine about. So he's almost certainly right, and I'm almost certainly wrong.
I definitely knew Andrew Seidel's qualifications. I was just joking about past debates we've had. All right. Well, with that said, let's get to our show today. down
the law, breaking
down
the law,
breaking down
the law,
breaking down
the law.
Breaking down the law. What? Okay, Andrew, everybody, as always happens after these events, we've got lots of group. We got lots of people saying, don't politicize this, which is the most nonsensical thing I've ever heard. I don't know how you feel about that, but it gets really frustrating because it's obviously just not them not wanting to talk about the problem.
Yeah, well, it bothers me for two reasons. Number one, it's an idiotic thing to say to a politician.
Yeah.
Look, that's true when Democrats say it as well, right? And number two, the only thing a politician can do, I mean, you know, the only useful thing a politician can do is propose legislative solutions to stuff, right? Like everything else is just, you know, a guy with shellacked hair saying our, you know, thoughts and prayers are with you, right? Like proposing legislative solutions in the wake of tragedy is what legislators are supposed to do. So, that's a dumb
call. Yeah, I agree.
And it's dumb, and I want to say call us out because it's a dumb complaint when Democrats make it about Republicans.
I don't know. What? When do Democrats do that? Because you're
right. I can't come up with a good example of that. Me neither, I'm just trying to be bipartisan. Dan, the conservative man, let us know the last time Democrats accused Republicans of overly politicizing something.
Yeah, sure.
In the wake of a tragedy.
Yeah.
I can't come up with one, but if you do, I'll condemn that probably.
Right. Yeah. So as we all know, I mean, this thing was horrific. It's awful. It's really hard to even process. The shooter killed himself afterwards, which everyone always says, if you could just reverse the order of that, if you're going to go on a massacre, please do a suicide massacre, do the suicide part first. If you're going to do that. I mean, if you plan on killing a bunch of people, start with yourself. That's all I have to say. He had 23 firearms, including an AR-15, a Daniel Defense DDM-4, never even heard of that one, FN Herstal, I know nothing about guns. Anyone who knows anything about guns is laughing at me right now.
Yeah, no, and I know very, very little about guns. It's part of why I want to, you know, kind of tread lightly in this area sometimes. I think those are variants of the AR-15, right? Like, okay. So the AR-15 is a semi-automatic, I think, they may also have a fully automatic version of a military weapon. And then there are these additional weapons that kind of take the AR-15 body and then make a few cosmetic changes to it. But they're basically the same weapon.
Yeah. And he had other military weapons, a Kalashnikov, AR-10, let's see, two of the rifles were mounted on sniper bipods and were equipped with telescopic sights. The guns were modified semi-automatic weapons that can simulate automatic firing. He also had a lot of high-capacity magazines that can hold up to 100 rounds apiece. So, Andrew, I guess a lot of people hear that and think, wow, it seems pretty insane that someone could have all that. Like, why? What is our society that's something someone can do? So what gives? I mean... Is that all legal? Well, I know the thing to modify the gun into a fully automatic probably isn't legal, right?
You would think, but in researching the story, I discovered a couple of things. And again, not a gun guy. Mm-hmm. Brian, my friend who listens to the show, is a gun guy. So let me know if I get something wrong here. I always thought of modifying a semi-automatic to become an automatic was like, you know, disassembling the guts and, you know, doing X, Y. One of the mods that I discovered is putting the safety on, using a rubber band to hold the trigger back, and then turning the safety off. Apparently, because the idea is a semi-automatic pulls every time you fire the trigger, and so some of the weapons, it's not like a old-timey pistol where, like, you know, the kind I used to play with as a kid, you know, replicas where, you know, you pull back the trigger and it clicks, and then you know what. But no, you could as fast as you can twitch your finger, it can spit out a bullet, and so there are devices that basically increase the twitch of your finger. So pulling back a rubber band. There's also this thing called having a bump stock, which apparently some of those stocks were. And again, my understanding.
I've seen that. I could be wrong. I don't know if this is what you're going to say, but I've seen a video where – there's a way you can hold it and use it where, like, as you fire it, the recoil makes you just essentially fire it like an automatic because it.
That's
recoil,
exactly right.
Okay, yeah. I've seen that before. I wonder if that was something he was from the 30 whatever floor. I don't know if that was what he was doing, but he had those devices that made it pretty much fully automatic, right?
Correct. And again, this is an area where I did talk to a gun expert, and if you receive police or military training, right, the kind of limp bump stock, I mean, it's the exact opposite of how a trained professional would want to fire these weapons, right? It is only useful for doing what the shooter here did, which was spray bullets indiscriminately into a large mass of people. Right. Which is just not, you know, that's not what police are trained to do. That's not what you're trained to do in the military. It is, you know.
It's only for awful mass killing purposes.
Correct. So there's a little bit of hypothetical to the to this discussion, sadly, because, you know, there is.
Like hypothetically, what if we gave a shit? Yeah. You were going to say. Okay.
Yeah.
I was going to make a joke, but that is actually what you're going to say. Like,
no,
hypothetically, what if anyone cared enough to try to do something about this?
Right. Well, did you see the talking points that the Trump administration put out after, I mean, like almost immediately after the news of the tragedy hit?
I don't think I did. I was a little busy, but
fair.
That's
a fair point. I'm going to link them in the show notes. But yeah, they released NBC, Hallie Jackson has a screenshot, but they released a screenshot to Twitter that says, "Gun control. Let's gather all the facts before we make sweeping policy arguments for curtailing the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment has endured for more than two centuries for a reason. It is a key constitutional right that is meant to protect people's freedoms. And the president understands that. The president believes that our founding principles must be protected while maintaining public safety. We welcome a reasoned and well-informed debate, but we reject the false choice that we can't have both. And when it comes to gun control, let's be clear, new laws won't stop a madman committed to harming innocent people. They will curtail the freedoms of law-abiding citizens. We've seen terrorist attacks committed with knives by people driving cars into crowds and hijacking airplanes. And some of America's cities with the strictest
Imagine
gun laws.
Imagine if he had driven his car from the 34th window.
Or thrown knives down. Right, exactly. Yeah,
no, he could have poked someone.
Right. And some of America's cities with the strictest gun laws have the highest rates of gun violence. Example, Chicago had 4,300 shooting victims last year. Baltimore last year had over 900 shooting victims. This shows that more laws on the book may not work. The problem in these cities and many others isn't too few gun laws." And I'm not going to, there's another kind of point on your not political. I mean, like, that's a political document.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, let's not politicize it in your direction. Let's definitely politicize it in my direction, though.
Yeah.
I mean, have we tried thoughts and prayers for this? Did we try that? Is that?
Yeah.
Does that work?
That resulted in 59 dead and 489.
The one thing I will say is I don't know how you feel about this, but it might be entirely true that a lot of proposed gun control measures aren't going to stop someone from, you know, illegally stockpiling a bunch of weapons and doing, you know, like it might be true that it's not going to stop this kind of thing. What do you think? I mean, I guess we're going to talk about it.
So it seems to me that there are two types of restrictive gun control laws that we could talk about coming out of the Las Vegas massacre. The first would be reviving some sort of semi-automatic assault weapons ban, banning the weapons that were used and similar weapons. That's been tried at several points on a federal level, is continuing to be tried on the state level. The second, and you and I talked about this the last time we discussed guns, we did a masterclass in OA on episodes 21 and 26. I'm going to link that in the show notes. You should go back and listen to that. Not you, Thomas. I'm really, really proud of those episodes. I mean, we went through the full history, kind of removed from any political context, of what the Second Amendment means, and showed, you know, sort of how radical a departure the current view of the Second Amendment is. But the thing that we talked about in that episode, when we sort of veered into the political arena, that I would like to see part of the public debate right now, is restricting access to high capacity magazines. Again, I offer, we always get comments, and I'm glad we get email comments from gun folks when we move into gun issues. I have expressed some sympathy with that, right? I am not a gun owner. I have never fired a firearm. I certainly would be willing to go out to a range and do that. And I have some sensitivity at, you know, here's somebody who's not a gun guy talking about restricting what another gun, what a gun person, you know, what somebody who might own a gun might do, right? And there is some danger in that. I've never talked to anybody who can give me a good argument beyond keep government out of my business for not restricting the sale of high capacity.
Well, there was magazines. That time we all had to use our personal guns to overthrow an entire government. Oh, that was in 17 something with muskets. But other than that, there, No, I think that I want to clarify just because what I was saying earlier, it's my view and it might not, you know, I don't know that I have the correct view on this, but my current view is that I just feel like we need something absolutely extreme in order to really stop this kind of thing, or at least reduce this kind of thing. And we're just nowhere near doing that. So what we get is a lot of half measures and minor gun control things that don't really do anything. And then people on the right are able to, or just gun loving people are able to point to like, well, look, that doesn't really, you know, have the effect you want. And it's frustrating because it's like, well, okay, we just want to do something, you know? And
well,
yeah.
And let me push back against that a little bit, which is to say, I mean, first, I certainly understand that viewpoint. But one of the things that I like to point out is that the argument of this isn't going to help was made in the early 1990s after the sort of first rash of violence that led to increased national interest in gun control laws. And when we had a Democratic president and a Democratic Congress, we passed the Brady Bill, which required, among other things, 3-day waiting period and background check before you could buy a gun. And opponents said, oh, well, look, like criminals are still going to buy guns from, you know, the secret criminal underground empire store where they all go. And this is never going to work. It's just going to inconvenience law abiding citizens. Tens of thousands of people were arrested after the Brady Bill. So as it turns
for
out,
buying
like,
guns illegally, you know, selling guns illegally.
Yeah. I mean, for trying to buy that is they failed the background check, right? Like people would show up and, you know, would have multiple outstanding felony arrests on their record. And yet they would still, you know, go into Walmart to buy the gun because as it turns out, like this, you know, there isn't, I mean, it's why I made the joke about, you know, the black, like life isn't like a video game where, you know, you can just descend beneath the sewers and like there's the secret criminal shop down there where you can buy, like, no, all we know is that empirically, these arguments were made about the Brady Bill and the Brady Bill absolutely caught, you know, tens of thousands of folks who were attempting to purchase firearms illegally. And so I don't, I think if you use that as the model, if you had a restriction that basically said, you know, you can use high capacity magazines can be sold to authorized gun range owner, right? You know, to authorized training facilities.
Well, no matter what we do, my view has always been, if you want to have some availability at gun ranges for any gun, like I don't care. That's fine. I'm not worried about that. Yep. You know, if we, even if I had my way and we just got rid of guns, I would still say, okay, you can have them at gun ranges.
Right. And if we restricted, I don't see that there's certainly nothing in our immediate history that suggests that we would not be reasonably effective in being able to keep high capacity magazines off the streets. You know, is it going to fix every, it's obviously not going to fix everything. You know, will some people evade it? Obviously some people will evade it, but you know, the types of mass shootings that we have seen of, you know, disgruntled children and, you know, just sort of angry crimes of opportunity. I mean, we still don't know, you know, the motivations behind this shooter, but you know, he showed up at a Las Vegas casino with 10 suitcases and nobody said, why are you moving 10 suitcases into your hotel room?
Yeah, but, I mean, it's Vegas. I Who the hell knows what they're used to seeing? You know, I don't know.
Yeah, right. That's a fair point. But look, like, it would have been, there would have been delays that would have allowed the crowd more time to disperse, even using, you know, the military style assault weapons, even modified on full auto. There's a difference between spraying 10 bullets at somebody and spraying 100 and then grabbing a gun and getting another 100, right?
Yeah, that seems like a massive difference.
Yeah. And so now the question is, is anything the Trump administration has said in this little talking point list remotely correct? And my view is, in light of the Colby versus Hogan case, which we discussed in opening arguments, episode 47, no, none of it is. So let's kind of talk a little bit about, we know DC versus Heller was a radical departure in that it established for the first time ever that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to own weapons. And if that seems like a weird thing in, you know, given our recent history of the past 20 years, go back and listen to OA 21 and 26. For 200 years in this country, nobody thought the Second Amendment protected an individual right to own weapons. But D.C. Heller said that it did. It struck down the 30-year-old at the time comprehensive ban on handguns in the District of Columbia, because certainly the one thing the District of Columbia needs is more people with firearms. And, oh, sorry, that's you're going to lose two more conservative listeners there.
Yeah. Well, you see, if everybody in the crowd had a handgun and just fired it back into the hotel.
Shot back up. Yeah, right. Yeah. So after that, and that decision was 2008, there were some serious questions as to whether any gun control would be permissible in this country. Yeah, you know, the kinds of things that I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And in 2013, Maryland passed a ban that's directly on point here. They banned the AR-15 and other what they called military-style rifles and shotguns, and they banned detachable large-capacity magazines. So the exact two things that people are talking about in the wake of the tragedy in Las Vegas, Maryland banned in 2013, and that was challenged. Various gun groups brought lawsuits, and various interest groups brought lawsuits, and they claimed that in light of DC versus Heller, that was unconstitutional. And the interesting thing in my view in Colby versus Hogan is it's an en banc decision of the Fourth Circuit, right? So it's all the judges. It vacated a prior decision of a panel, 3-judge panel of the Fourth Circuit, which upheld Maryland's gun control law, right? And the reason that the Fourth Circuit en banc vacated that earlier opinion was that the earlier opinion said, yes, the Second Amendment protects your right to own an assault weapon and large capacity magazine. But in this case, the proper balancing test of whether the government can override that right, which they applied an intermediate scrutiny test, means that it's permissible that this law is going to stand. And what the Fourth Circuit did was they withdrew that opinion and they said, no, the Second Amendment does not protect assault weapons and high capacity magazines at all.
Yeah. I can't imagine how it would. I mean, the magazine thing, especially, it's like, you know, that doesn't affect your right to bear arms. I don't understand.
And the way they got there was by taking advantage of Justice Scalia's cavalier disregard for precedent.
Yeah.
So here's the original passage in DC versus Heller, which again, we'll link in the show notes. Scalia says, although we do not undertake an exhaustive historical analysis today of the full scope of the Second Amendment, nothing in our opinion should be taken to cast doubt on longstanding prohibitions on the possessions of firearms by felons and the mentally ill, or laws forbidding the carrying of firearms in sensitive places, such as schools or government buildings, or laws imposing conditions and qualifications on the commercial sale of arms. We also recognize another important limitation on the right to keep and carry arms. Miller, that's the Miller v. U.S. decision, upheld the ban on sawed-off shotguns that we discuss at length in OA 21 and 26. Miller said, as we have explained, that the sorts of weapons protected were those, quote, in common use at the time, end of quote. We think that limitation is fairly supported by the historical tradition of prohibiting the carrying of, quote, dangerous and unusual weapons, end quote. And then in the next paragraph, instead of dangerous and unusual weapons, Scalia uses the term weapons that are most useful in military service, M16 rifles and the like, which may be banned. Right. And now you read that, and I should have read it with Scalia's trademark sarcasm and disdain. And you can see him saying, these little things out here. And he's deliberately minimizing the Miller opinion, right? Like Miller says, the only thing that the Second Amendment protects are weapons in common use at the time. And Scalia shifts the burden on that to, okay, well, if something is so, you know, dangerous and unusual, then it falls within that. And so, but nevertheless, that language is there. In the Heller decision. And the Colby case runs with it and says, yeah, that's right. So what Heller stands for is you can't ban handguns. You can't ban weapons that were in ordinary use at the time. But what you can ban are military style weapons and the like, right? Those are right. Scalia's own words. We didn't make that up. And then the opinion actually begins with a page long description of the Sandy Hook massacre in Newtown, Connecticut, and notes that in response to Newtown, the state of Maryland enacted their Firearms Safety Act in 2013, which then banned the assault weapons and detachable large capacity magazines, and that's the final word. The Colby versus Hogan decision was not appealed to the Supreme Court. It is only binding on states within the Fourth Circuit's mm-hmm. jurisdiction, so Maryland, Virginia, West Virginia. But nevertheless, you know, like a lot of these en banc decisions of an appeals court, you know, we've talked about Hively versus Ivy Tech, right? Like we've talked about how these decisions will carry persuasive weight in other jurisdictions. And so at this point in time, on both the federal and the state level, under the best analysis that I can come up with of the current state of, you know, what the Second Amendment protects and doesn't protect, there's no Second Amendment implication by certainly by banning high capacity magazines, but also by banning military style assault rifles. I know we're going to get, you know, links to arguments from gun guys that say, you know, that's not a meaningful distinction, and that the, you know, the guts of X weapon are equivalent to the guts of Y weapon, and that there's a lot of cosmetic changes and that sort of thing. I've seen those arguments. I don't know how to evaluate that because I'm not a gun person, but I will tell you that's the distinction the courts have made. That's the distinction Antonin Scalia made in D.C. versus Heller. So, yeah. You know, send those arguments to the estate of Antonin Scalia. Please do, actually.
And just to emphasize, D.C. v. Heller is a travesty, right?
Right. But I am assuming that, you know, for the immediate future.
No, I know. I just want to, because I don't know how hard you hit on that, and I don't know how many people have listened back to a year ago or more when we did that, but that is a crap decision that really likely has led to a lot of this. I mean, it totally overturned directly. Precedent, and just wanted to emphasize. It's frustrating.
No, I appreciate and agree. And I think, you know, again, we've said go back and listen to episodes 21 and 26. Even if you did the first time around, you should be surprised at the sort of wholesale rewriting of what the Second Amendment means that has been perpetrated upon us in the last 20 to 30 yeah. years.
Plus, you know, it's always fun. The innocence of listening to Back Before Trump is always, it's always a nice experience. But all right, we've got so much to get to. That could have been its own main segment. I think that's probably going to be true of a lot of our segments today. So let's go on with the rest of the show. Thanks for breaking that down.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president is a crook.
Nobody so you're not aware of any context during the course of the election?
How many times do I have to answer this question?
Can you just say
Russia
yes or no
is
on
a
it?
Ruse. I know you have to get up and ask a question so important. Russia is a ruse.
Well, I'm not a crook.
All right. You heard the music. You heard it, Andrew. And I got to say, I was given over the weekend the only redeeming thing was I was given the best shirt, and I have one for you. The best shirt of all time. And I believe, now apologies because it was a horrible weekend. I met so many people I don't remember, but I think it was Cindy who gave me this shirt. And you have to see, it's a tie-dye shirt, and the front is Yodel Mountain Conspiracy. so it's our band shirt, you know, it's our tour shirt. And on the back, it says Clear as Kushner Tour. And then it has a list of cities. It is incredible. I was really in a bad way for a minute this weekend, and it was one thing that helped cheer me up a lot. Absolutely hilarious shirt. So with that in mind, I think that is this segment in shirt form. So what do we got? Is something Clear as Kushner? Did we get him? Is it over?
Just yesterday, a story broke on Politico that the legal memoranda prepared by the Department of Justice, by Trump's Department of Justice, to permit Jared Kushner to serve as a presidential advisor, deliberately disregarded and overruled 30 years of internal memoranda that were sitting there, you know, to the contrary, that it was in fact, you know, clear as Kushner that it would violate the nepotism laws. I wanted to tackle this because even stories that are reporting, like the Politico story has a little bit at the end, but certainly other places that have picked it up and your Uncle Frank arguing on YouTube or Twitter have argued, well, you know, Bill Clinton brought in Hillary to run healthcare, so it's okay. And that narrative is as wrong as it's possible to be within the context of saying it. So I want to talk about the Bill and Hillary Clinton thing and why it's not relevant to allowing.
Yeah, and plus it's not as though Kushner and a bunch of other people from the department are using personal emails servers they did that. Okay, so go on.
Right. So the argument is, Bill Clinton let Hillary Clinton run healthcare. Therefore, Donald Trump can bring in as federal government employees Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump. And oh, by the way, they're going to forego their salary. So, you know, that will be okay.
That solves it.
The case that discusses what happened with Hillary Clinton is American Associations of Physicians and Surgeons versus Clinton, 997 F. 2nd, 898. It's a D.C. Circuit Court of Appeal, 1993. So let's time travel back to a more delightful time, 1992, in which President Clinton did, in fact, name his wife Hillary, then the first lady. She was not a senator. She'd never held public office. She was just the first lady. And he named her to chair the task force on national healthcare reform. Also on that task force were numerous governmental employees, including secretaries of the Treasury, Defense, Veterans Affairs, Health and Human Services, Labor, and the Commerce Departments, the director of the Office of Management and Budget, chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, and three White House advisors. Okay, and Hillary Clinton was appointed to head that task force. The task force job was to liaison between interest groups and the president and ultimately prepare and deliver proposed legislation. Right. So that's what they were going to do. Within that task force, there was a working group of 500 people. So the task force itself is considerably larger than that. I can't find how big that was, but about 500 people comprised the working group. Those were mostly staffers. Those were the people who were tasked with writing the bill itself. So there you go, right? Case closed. Hillary Clinton chaired this thing.
Yeah. Let's impeach her.
Yeah. No, as it turns out, task forces aren't in and of themselves government jobs, right? And so I want to be clear on this. Donald Trump could put Jared Kushner or Ivanka Trump or Melania Trump or anybody he wants on any kind of task force that he wants. Nobody was claiming at the time that Hillary Clinton couldn't be put on a task force. Instead, the question was whether her appointment to that task force implicated an act called the Federal Advisory Committee Act, or FACA, 5 USC App 1. And that law requires that advisory committees meet in public. Okay. But it has an exclusion for advisory committees that are, this is section 3, subsection 2. They say the term advisory committee means, and it basically includes task forces and stuff like that. In fact, it specifically says any committee, board, commission, council, conference, panel, task force, or other similar group, except that such term excludes any committee that is composed wholly of full-time or permanent part-time officers or employees of the federal government. Okay. And here's the reason for that exclusion, right? There are really two. The first is that you have, again, we've talked about this before, the notion of executive privilege, right? That when you gather together your inner circle of advisors, you want, as the president, to be able to ask them candidly right. for advice, and you want them candidly to be able to render advice without having to
not be worried about it being in public in the future.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And then the second is that government employees are subject to nepotism and conflicts of interest laws, right? And so, in fact, in the opinion, it's page 921 of the concurrence, there's six different laws that apply to government employees when they serve on task forces, including the Ethics in Government Act. But committees that have people who are not government employees on them have members who are not required to give up their private affiliations and insulate themselves against conflicts of interest. And so the way in which we check against those conflicts of interest is by saying, okay, you can have a task force, you can write legislation, you can advise the president, but those proceedings have to be out in the open because you haven't been vetted. We want to know, you know, what these people are saying. So that's what the Clinton case was about. The healthcare task force wanted to meet in secret. And the reason they wanted to meet in secret, the stated reason, you can dispute it if you want. Mm-hmm. But the stated reason was because they did not want the proceedings to be subject to lobbying by the healthcare industry. Right. Hmm. They said, look, we want to take, this is why they've got like Veterans Affairs on there. And they were like, look, we're going to figure out how healthcare is a problem across society, but we're not going to listen to the people who have a vested financial interest in maintaining it the way it is.
Okay.
And, you know, again, you can politically, you can agree, disagree.
Because I think they wanted to be secret because they were planning to murder Seth Rich, but.
Right. Yeah. 20 years. Hence.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And so FACA says that any advisory committee not comprised entirely of full-time or permanent part-time officers or employees of the federal government must meet in public. So So there was a lawsuit, and the district court took what you might think would be the final word, we might think might be where we were going, which is task force doesn't meet that exception because Hillary Clinton isn't a government employee. It cited the anti-nepotism law. It says she couldn't be a government employee. She'd be prohibited. So therefore, FACA applies and you have to meet in public. Hmm. And then the Clinton administration appealed to the D.C. Court of Appeals, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. And that court reversed on a 3-0 decision with a concurrence. It said that the task force did meet the exception because the position of First Lady was an officer of the government, though not an employee. It's a weird case, okay?
Yeah.
And I have to say, I said it was a unanimous decision. The concurrence concurs in the judgment on presidential immunity grounds, the right to confer, but disagrees with respect to Hillary Clinton. And I think that concurrence written by Judge Buckley, I think that is the much sounder decision here, right? So I don't want to defend the decision other than to say, you know, it's good law and to walk through. But here's the two arguments that were raised in the majority opinion. Okay. First, they said that the position of First Lady was expressly recognized by Congress as a presidential advisor. This is page 904 of the opinion. Congress itself has recognized that the president's spouse acts as the functional equivalent of an assistant to the president. The legislative authorization to the president to pay his White House aides includes the following provision, and this is 3 U.S.C. 105E. Assistance and services authorized pursuant to this section to the president are authorized to be provided to the spouse of the president in connection with assistance provided by such spouse to the president in the discharge of the president's duties and responsibilities. If the president does not have a spouse, such assistance and services may be provided for such purposes to a member of the president's family whom the president designates. Okay. So that was their first reason for saying Hillary Clinton, as first lady, is an officer of the country, even though she's not an employee, because Congress made a specific provision for spouses. And then second, they said as a result of that, it would be stupidly easy to circumvent the law if they didn't hold that way. And they really said this. They said, pursuant to this section, moreover, the president's spouse is supported by a substantial staff who are undeniably full-time government officers or employees. Therefore, the president could have, as the government points out, easily designated Mrs. Clinton's chief of staff as a member of the task force, perhaps even as its chairman, who would then be expected to report to Mrs. Clinton. It would seem quite anomalous to conclude that FACA would apply if the president's spouse were a member of the committee, but not if her chief of staff were the actual member. Okay. And so that's the reason that the majority gave. And notice that that 3 U.S.C. 105 explanation can't possibly apply to Donald Trump in these cases because it only applies to the spouse of the president. Or right. If the president does not have a spouse, then he can designate another family member. But this president has a spouse. He's got three of them, in fact. Now, I do want to say that there is dicta in the opinion about the nepotism law, and this is not well-reasoned. Okay, and this is the court essentially makes a Seth Barrett Tillman kind of argument. Okay, they say 5 U.S.C. 3110 prohibits any, quote, public official from appointing or employing a relative, such as a spouse, in the agency in which he is serving or over which he exercises jurisdiction or control. Although that section defines agency as an executive agency, we doubt that Congress intended to include the White House or the executive office of the president. And then it cites to three cases that show that that have held in other contexts that the presidency or his advisors are not an agency for purposes of like the Administrative Procedure Act. Then the court goes on. So, for example, a president would be barred from appointing his brother as attorney general, but perhaps not as a White House special assistant, which that's the line if you're Jared Kushner that you want to seize on.
Was that because of JFK or something? Or
yeah, remember that the Anti-Nepotism Act was passed
because of
JFK appointing Robert Kennedy as Attorney General. So that's the reference. So they say, the Anti-Nepotism Act would prohibit you from making your brother Attorney General, but maybe not a White House special assistant, right? But then they say, be that as it may, it's not reasonable to interpret that provision to bring it into conflict with Congress's recognition of and apparent authorization for the president's delegation of duties to his spouse. The anti-nepotism statute, moreover, may well bar appointment only to paid positions in government. Thus, even if it would prevent the president from putting his spouse on the federal payroll, it does not preclude his spouse from aiding the president in the performance of his duties. Okay, so that's the area you want to hang on to if you're pro-Kushner. The concurrence, I think, demolishes this argument. It says the act, the Anti-Nepotism Act, declares that public officials, expressly including the president, may not employ relatives, expressly including a wife, in, quote, a civilian position in the agency in which he is serving or over which he exercises jurisdiction or control. The use of the definite article in the phrase the agency in which he is serving appears to imply that every public official belongs to some agency and that their relatives may not be employed in that agency, whatever it happens to be. Moreover, as a matter of policy and consistency, the restrictions on the president under the Anti-Nepotism Act must be viewed as broad as the executive branch. It is inconceivable that Congress, in combating nepotism, intended to forbid Mrs. Clinton's service as attorney general while permitting her appointment as national security advisor. Viewed as matter of congressional intent, and the NSA, the reason that's funny is because, right, the NSA is a member of the It includes under the executive office of the president.
Right.
So viewed purely as a matter of congressional intent, the argument that the Anti-Nepotism Act applies only to the departments and not to the White House is a weak one. So,
give it to you. Long story short, can we lock her up or no?
Yeah, right. No. So anybody who is saying that, again, we went through this case in mind-numbing detail because I wanted to be fully transparent about the furthest extent to which the law could possibly be applied. There is no case that says close family members of the president can serve so long as they don't take a salary in the government. There is, in fact, the anti-nepotism law, which is as broad as the concurrence says that it is. There is one case that suggests that there is a tension between the anti-nepotism law and the unique role of the president's spouse in conjunction with a third act of Congress. Whatever, but A, that's dicta. B, I don't think that case was supremely well reasoned. C, there's a concurrence in that case that I think rather convincingly knocks it out. But D, in any event, all of that only applies to the president's spouse and not to children, brother-in-law.
Time for them to have a gay wedding to make it right.
Still clear as Kushner.
So just to end that then, like what was the news about? You know, like, is anything going to happen? So we covered that the Hillary Clinton thing, not
obviously
the same.
Nothing's going to happen because the only...
You're right. You didn't even bother.
Yeah, the only remedy here is for Paul Ryan to grow a spine. And that's, you know... or, again, for the Democrats to retake Congress in 2018. So, you know, while you're out there, if this makes you mad, you might want to ask your local candidate for Congress, you know, where they stand on these issues. But other than replacing or reprogramming Paul Ryan, nope.
All right. Well, clear as Kushner. There you have it.
Yep.
Thanks for breaking that down. And I am just blown away that for once Hillary was more, or Bill, I suppose, were more principled than Donald Trump. I'm so surprised. I don't even know how to handle it.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president is a crook.
Nobody so you're not aware of any context during the course of the election?
How many times do I have to answer this question?
Can you just say
Russia
yes or no
is
on
a
it?
Ruse? Yeah, I know you have to get up and ask a question so important. Russia is a ruse.
Well, I'm not a crook.
All right, let's get to our bonus yodel. It's back-to-back yodeling. So we are once again, now we took a break. We had the rules state we have to go back down from Yodel Mountain and then come back. But we've done right. So. We're out of breath. What what's this second Yodel Mountain? Donald Trump and Donald Trump Jr. and Ivanka nearly indicted in 2012.
Breaking story. It's been reported in a number of outlets. First in ProPublica in connection with WNYC, but it has subsequently been reported in other venues that in 2012, the prosecutors in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office were prepared to indict Ivanka Trump and Donald Trump Jr. In connection with misrepresentations made by the Trump Soho Hotel and Condominium Building. So what is this? Trump built a big hotel condo that he called Trump Soho, even though it's not actually in the Soho district in New York. And people didn't buy condos in it.
This sounds familiar.
Lots of reasons. Yeah. And so one of the things that is apparently, I've never bought a condominium, so didn't know this, but one of the
Patreon
things
goal,
that is,
opening arguments, yeah. Condominium.
First we'll go harass Pauly Shore, then we'll buy a condo. Apparently one of the big determinants in the market value of a condo is how many units in the building were sold. And in fact, there were certain thresholds where they had to let people out of leases if under 15% of the units were sold.
Wow.
So, because I guess people don't like to live in big empty buildings, right? And so Ivanka and Donald Trump Jr. were going around at the time saying that the building was 60% sold.
Mm.
And so
it's one of those, it's like when you hear they're pitching a new film and they go to, you know, an actor like Tom Cruise is definitely in, he's 100% in. And they, you know, and then they go to the other guy, you know, they go back to Tom Cruise and they're like, John Travolta is definitely, it's a 90s Scientology movie. John Travolta is definitely in. So you need to do it. So they go, they tell, is that what it is? Where like they're telling everybody it's sold in order to sell.
Exactly.
Okay.
That is exactly right. And so there's some quotes in the article. In April 2008, they said that 31% of the condos had been purchased immediately. Donald Jr. boasted to the Real Deal magazine that 55% of the units had been bought. Then a couple months later, Ivanka announced that 60% had been bought at a press conference. We're in a very fortunate position, she said, where we have enough sales and now we are strategically targeting certain buyers.
Exclusive. So then when they, God, they're such con artists. Unbelievable.
And so I can render no opinion on whether it is against the law to tell John Travolta that Tom Cruise is definitely involved with the project. It's definitely against New York law to make statements that are false or misleading in connection with real estate.
Yeah.
Okay.
That sounds like a good law.
It's probably it's a law called the Martin Act, and it bans any false statement made in connection with the sale of real estate. And then there were some other potential charges. So the Economic Crimes Division of the Manhattan District Attorney's Office prepared a report. The argument here from sources is that they were ready to indict both Donald Trump Jr. and Ivanka Trump in 2012.
Yet somehow I feel like they didn't. So what gives?
Yeah, they didn't. So interestingly enough,
all of that Economic Crimes Division wound up with condos. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Trump's personal lawyer, Mark Kasowitz, donated $25,000 to the reelection campaign of Cyrus Vance Jr., the district attorney of Manhattan, visited the office. Then Vance overruled his subordinates and said, no, we're not going to indict Donald Trump Jr. and Ivanka Trump. He subsequently said in connection with this article, I did not at the time believe beyond a reasonable doubt that a crime had been committed. I had to make a call. I made the call. I think I made the right call. Kasowitz had no influence and his contributions had no influence whatsoever on my decision-making in this case. But 6 months later, Kasowitz gave another $50,000 and got people from his law firm to make contributions to Vance's reelection campaign.
Wow.
So looks pretty much like a standard case.
That's like a comic book movie level crime.
Yeah.
That's like Batman's got to clean up this city level crime.
Yep. Yep. And so now the question is, and the reason I'm doing the segment is because our bribery laws are pathetically weak.
Mm.
And you may be familiar with the case of Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell. That case was covered extensively on the Rachel Maddow show, for example.
I think you've talked about this. Is it one of those issues where the intent is the problem? Like you can't prove. Is that why the laws are so weak?
That's part of it. But I'll read the relevant part of the statute, and then we'll talk about the case. So the statute says whoever directly or indirectly corruptly gives, offers, or promises anything of value to any public official or person who has been selected to be a public official, or offers or promises any public official or any person who has been selected to be a public official to give anything of value to any other person or entity with intent, 1A, to influence any official act, and then there's some other stuff, is guilty of bribery.
Well, sounds right? like he's
and
guilty.
So, yeah. So you have the two key things there are, number one, you must prove intent. We've talked about that at great length.
Yeah.
The difficulty in proving intent. But the second aspect is you have to influence an official act. Okay. And this is where the Supreme Court's decision in McDonnell versus U.S., this is a 2016 case, comes into play. And this was the case of former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell. He got Bob McDonnell and his wife got $175,000 in secret gifts and other goodies from a businessman named Johnny Williams, who ran one of these garbage dietary supplement companies called Anatablock. The supplement industry as a whole is
a joke.
Mostly garbage, and this is part of that. And so undisputed, I mean, this is the case where he gave, you know, a fur coat to the to Maureen McDonnell. I mean,
fur coat is like the most classic bribery.
No, it really is. Yeah. I mean, it is. It is
probably should be mentioned in the statute somewhere. Like this is a. I mean, if you give a fur coat, you're strictly liable for a bribery. It should be in there. It's like money. We'll look at it. You know, we'll see what's going on. But fur coat, done. Like case closed. Yeah. Gavel.
And I mean, he rented, like, I think a Ferrari for him. I mean, again, oh really, this God. Is
put
like.
Put that in
this
there, is, too. Put that in the clause, too.
This is 80s villain level ridiculousness. And what Bob McDonald did was used his access to lobby on behalf of this company. Right. He introduced Williams to various government contractors, arranged for him to meet with government employees, held a launch event at the governor's mansion. Right. I mean, he was in the parlance of criminal bribery. Right. He was bought and he stayed bought. Right. And the Supreme Court said that's not enough. The Supreme Court said, in order to have an official act, you must actually make influence a decision or action on any question, matter, cause, suit, proceeding, or controversy that is pending before that public official. It must be specific and it must involve the formal exercise of government power. And it's that last phrase that is sort of the most troubling because in McDonnell, the Supreme Court said, yep, and this was a 9-0 decision, by the way. This is not a 5-4 like, you know, Scalia. 9-0, the Supreme Court said, it's really, really clear. I can give a ton of money. I can give fur coats and Ferraris to a governor. And the governor can introduce me around as his pal and pull strings on my behalf. But if he does not engage in the formal exercise of governmental power on a specific pending issue, question, whatever, then it's not an official act.
I like my strictly liable version better.
I like your version so much better. now, look, here there was a pending potential for indictment. And the statute, you know, includes existing cases and also cases that are pending or potential to be brought. So they're not going to get out of that, that there wasn't an investigation that could have led to an indictment. But they might get out on the formal exercise of power to say, is it a formal exercise of power to engage in prosecutorial discretion to overrule your subordinates?
It's got
to
be.
Well, you'd think that. One argument that Kasowitz is going to make, and by the way, this would run to Kasowitz, right? To prove that it would run to Trump would add another layer of, you know, proving intent, would another layer of complexity.
Wait, the case is pretty good. Sorry, wouldn't Kasowitz. It go to Trump Jr. and Ivanka?
Well, they weren't the ones who bribed anybody.
Oh, right? I see. Okay.
Kasowitz was the one who bribed.
They just lied. And,
yeah, right. Yeah, what you do is you bring the case against Kasowitz and then you get Kasowitz to flip on Trump and the family. So what Kasowitz is going to argue, and here when I was doing the research, there's a blog post by a friend of the show, Randall Eliason. I'm going to link in the show notes. There are state statutes that add recommendation and exercise of discretion to that list of what constitutes an official act.
I mean,
act, right?
That
and
has so, to be. I'm flabbergasted that wouldn't I just, would. Can you or I exercise prosecutorial discretion? No, only that one person in that position can do it. You know, like.
I am with you. I'm with you on the argument. I'm just pointing out what we are going to see in the event that bribery charges are filed against Mark Kasowitz. And again, look, we don't know, but on the basis of this story, that certainly looks like a textbook case. Yeah. And then the question is, how would you go about proving it? What are the roadblocks in the way? And one of the roadblocks is this, you know, we already know intent is a roadblock. A second one is what constitutes an official act. I'm on board with your argument. I just want you to know that Kasowitz's lawyers are going to argue that
right.
exercising prosecutorial discretion is not an official act. Oh, and, you know, look, like he just, it just so happens that, you know, this rich and powerful lawyer's rich and powerful clients, I might have made a decision in their favor after receiving a giant. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Sorry, but it's not as though prosecutorial discretion is like, I never heard of that case. I've never known. I don't know anything about. Right. It's got to be you look into it. You do official work. Someone's working on it. Right. And then you make a decision. No, not going to pursue charges or indictment or whatever. Right. I mean,
right. Exactly.
Yeah. Whatever. All right. So, well, that's clear. I would say so. Just a Yodel Mountain conspiracy clarification, not directly implicating Trump, even in the best case scenario on this lawsuit. Right. It's just it could be Trump Jr.
Correct.
And Ivanka.
Okay. Correct. Correct.
But I mean, I think that chips away at Yodel Mountain. If they were somehow like best case scenario, they're found guilty of something like this, I think that would do a lot to erode his approval rating and therefore maybe drive Congress toward doing something. But who knows? That's the optimist.
Again, right. The benefit here is if you get criminal leverage over Mark Kasowitz, that's a huge plus. Mm. Right.
All right. Okay, well, thanks for covering that. We got a double Yodel Mountain. I mean, what a deal, everybody. I just two Yodel Mountains in one episode. And now is our co-favorite time of the week. It doesn't get much better than this. We've got to thank our top patrons, our Hall of Famers. And Andrew, why don't you start us off?
Yeah, thank you to Chrissy, to Kaylee Reiser, to Major Dennis Bloodnock, late of the third Disgusting Fusiliers, to Heather Loveridge, Aaron Grady, Adam Lenda, Soggy Pants, Stephen Boyd at DJ Empirical, Sam Danow, Eli Bosnick, Teresa, Thomas's goon and napkin lawyer Gomez, this person for making me say this. I love all our patrons, but I hate you. And I hate you, Thomas, for making me try this. To sixth six shakes, sixth sheep, sick dick.
I don't understand why you had a problem with that. It's just sixth six sheep, sixth sheep, six dick. I don't know. Is there an issue? I don't get it. It seems clear to me.
To Hunter Ash, to Ian and Allie, our friends. I met Ian and Allie in Salt Lake City.
Oh, yay.
And they were lovely and fantastic. And thank you. To Dave, co-founder of the Florida chapter of Thomas's Goon Squad, Nichols. Jim Grove, Jeffrey Maynor, Keith Davies, Jaga, the co-host of the Shifty Bastards Transformation Podcast, Malaika Chandler, Jesse Studd is my favorite lawyer, Andrew's a close second, POTUS supports dead Puerto Ricans. Ouch. Wow.
But at least he throws paper towels at him. So, give him that.
Yeah. Matthew Vernon, Thomas takes the perch exam, Squick Thigger. CampQuest.org, 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 Tricicular Manslaughter, and Philip Stromberg. You guys get better every
it's
week.
It's so great. I hope no one fast forwards this because it really is like one of the best parts of the show. And I want to thank the Wayward Willis podcast, Adopt a Homeless Pet and Oppose Declawing and Ear Docking, Dan, Proud to Be Thomas's Goon, Rebecca Smelzer, Rhonda the Dork, Roger Metcalf and the Hired Goons. I've got so many goons now. I'm going to need some middle goon management. Like I'm going to need, I can no longer handle all my goons. Sammy, C6 Sarah, throwing devil horns at the feet of cosmic Jesus. Well, that's interesting.
that's a reference to me. I did that this weekend.
Torsten Peel of NoSeboMart.com with Evil Salt. Danny Baker at Combat Nonsense. And finally, thank you to the Grand Duke Nile. They always try to trick us. Violet Page Hall, Secular Saint, Frederick Elstromer, Stop Breaking the Law, Asshole, in all caps. Cody Bond, Join the DSA to Fight for Single-Payer Medicare for All, good cause. Eric Johnson, Jessica Wilson, Mitchell, Reasonable Risk Podcast has been cured of Lyme disease. Nice one. Thomas McCormick, Thomas is Chief Goon. Oh, well, there you go. I've got a Chief Goon. Now, okay, that worked out perfectly. I didn't even plan that. So now, okay, Chief Goon, can you coordinate all the other goons, do payroll, that kind of stuff? IPAs are a borderline war crime. Whoa.
Ooh.
Whoa. Well, you're lucky you're one of our top patrons because, your message, we will not silence you. That is a message you have gotten out there. We don't endorse that message, but you've had your say. Conrad Michaels and Zabby, thank you guys so much. Your support is amazing. We're still, because we got that monthly drop off, so we're still hovering around that $2,000 live show goal. I think, you know, I, for one, I know, I'm sure you agree, Andrew, I still consider us having made that goal, but, you know, we're still around it. So we'll do it. We'll go through with it. But yeah, get us over that hump if you don't mind. All right. Thank you so much. And Lot Awful Movies, it's out now. It was a little delayed, but this one was excellent. The movie, and we can say this for every single one, but the movie was better than Jury Duty. That is the
you
trial.
You will not want to miss the trial of the Incredible Hulk.
No, there's extensive legal analysis in this one, so you don't want to miss it. Check it out. We've got the audio version of the Q&A is also out. Those are honestly that great content. I mean, Andrew answers all the questions that listeners have for him. Well, not all of them, because Andrew's really slow. But
I answered a Transformers related question. You'll have to listen to it to find out. So
lots of fun stuff there. Thank you so much to those who can support. Hey, if you can't, never for a moment feel guilty that you can't. We'll always provide the main show twice a week for free. If you can't, please do not for a second feel guilty that you can't. But for those who can, we do our best to give you a little extra just to say thanks. So I hope you're enjoying it.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right. For today's TTTDBE, we've got a special guest, Andrew Seidel, back on the show. How you doing, Andrew?
I'm well. Thank you for having me back, guys.
We just wanted to see, you know, I've been doing too well on this exam. So, we want to, no, I've actually missed two in a row, but Andrew's going to be with us for Tuesday's show. But we've got him on here a little early just for bar exam purposes. It's always fun to have a guest doing that with us. So, Andrew Torres, I guess, let's see if I can turn this thing around. I think I was on such a tear and now I'm two in a row missed. So I'll have to see if I can make things go in a better direction here.
All right, Thomas and Andrew, are you ready?
I suppose so. Ready as you can be for the bar.
A female employee was fired as an executive assistant at the time when she was 7 months pregnant. She brought a Title VII civil rights action in federal court for gender discrimination against the employer. At trial, a former co-worker of the woman was not allowed to testify that she heard the human relations manager saying in an informal meeting that the plaintiff and her predecessor were both fired due to what the manager described as, quote, pregnancy complications, end quote. The proposed witness had been a vice president of the company and a close advisor to the president. Without the benefit of that vital testimony, the jury entered a verdict for the defendant employer. On appeal, the plaintiff argued that the testimony should have been allowed and that it was not hearsay under the federal rules. Will the court likely grant the appeal and order a new trial?
Okay, so it's always hearsay.
Lot
There's
to go
so
there,
much
yeah.
Hearsay, yeah.
So your choices are A, no, because the statement is clearly hearsay with no exception to the hearsay rule being applicable. B, no, because it was based on things the coworker heard from others, making it double hearsay that is never admissible. C, yes, because that kind of testimony is reliable and not excludable as hearsay. Or D, yes, because it was admissible under the spontaneous utterance exception to the hearsay rules.
Oh, all right, Andrew, now don't chime in. I got to, for the sanctity of the game, I got to answer this first so that I see, you know. So yeah. I don't want any help.
I think we should hear the statement that was excluded one more time just to be sure.
Sure. The statement is a former coworker of the woman was not allowed to testify that she heard the human relations manager saying in an informal meeting that the plaintiff and her predecessor were both fired due to what the manager described as, quote, pregnancy complications, end quote.
Well, here's what is confusing me that I'm sure will inevitably lead me to getting this wrong. They're saying on appeal, it says here, the plaintiff argued that the testimony should have been allowed and that it was not hearsay. What I don't get is like, wouldn't they argue it's hearsay, but it's an exception? Is that the same thing? Can you answer? I don't know if that gives away too much.
If that gives away too much,
don't tell me. And Andrew Seidel, no, let me answer first. Don't guess anything.
All right.
That's going to throw me off. Let me do my best to try to navigate this anyway. Cause my answer or what I would think the answer would be before I read the answers was, well, it sounds like hearsay. However, I would hope this would be an exception, but maybe maybe it's going to be the thing where, you know, Andrew, you tell me that it's, you know, you have to get the actual HR manager to testify and that is the better evidence or something. So I'm going to eliminate, let's see, I got to eliminate two here just to go with the previous playing of the game. I'm going to eliminate C, yes, because that kind of testimony is reliable and not excludable as hearsay. It seems to me it is hearsay. Like it doesn't, I don't think you can argue that. And then I'll try to eliminate a yes and a no answer. It's usually a safe way to go. Let's see. And then I'm going to eliminate B, no, because it was based on things that the coworker heard from others, making it double hearsay. Is never admissible. I don't think it's double hearsay. I feel like that's pretty typical hearsay. That could be a bad elimination, though. I'm going to try to eliminate B and C, and I'm going to go with A, no, because the statement is clearly hearsay with no exception to the hearsay rule being applicable. I have virtually no confidence in this answer, but that's my answer. It's A. I think that you need to get the HR manager to testify to what actually happened in that meeting and not merely the hearsay thing, but I could be wrong. I have no confidence in this one. All right, Andrew Seidel, tell us how it's done.
Well, I think your eliminations are good, and I agree with them. I agree with eliminating B and C.
You know why that is? Because Thomas's second chance bar exam is just as good as real lawyers. That's why that is. All right, okay.
There is a difference between things that are not hearsay and things that are hearsay, but exceptions to hearsay.
Right, right.
I tend to agree that this is hearsay, but I thought there was some medical exception to hearsay for like a medical diagnosis, but I don't remember if it had to be from a medical professional or not, or whether an HR person might qualify for that. And I'm not positive that it's even an exception. Andrew Torres, mm-hmm. can you read me A and D again real quick?
Sure. A is Thomas's answer. No, because the statement is clearly
hearsay. Hold on, I just
have
to point out that I love how you said Andrew Torres because you wanted to make sure you were talking about yourself.
Yes. Excellent point, Thomas. Excellent point.
So A is no, because the statement is clearly hearsay with no exception to the hearsay rule being applicable. And D is yes, because it was admissible under the spontaneous utterance exception to the hearsay rules.
It could be.
Yeah.
That.
See, I don't know. I don't know if I buy the spontaneous one. So maybe I'm wrong about the medical exception one. So I'm gonna go with A as well.
Wow. Wow. Well, that makes me feel better. So either we're both wrong or we're both expert lawyers. So.
Well, and part of it is right. The human resources person is a better person to get on the stand for that for sure.
Yeah. But what's throwing me off is if you and I are wrong and it is D, I'm really mad that the question said the plaintiff argued that the testimony should have been allowed and that it was not hearsay. Like, it's definitely hearsay. It's just it might be an exception, right? But whatever. Our answers are cemented. We'll have to find out on Tuesday's episode if we were both brilliant or both, you know, failing a lawyer. No. The bar exam is hard. Can't wait to find the answer. All right. So tune in on Tuesday. And of course, Andrew Seidel will be joining us for Tuesday's episode. Can't wait for that. So much to talk about. All right. Well, thank you so much for listening again. Thanks, Andrew, for breaking all that down. I cannot believe our luck as listeners that we got two yodels in one afternoon here. So thanks so much for listening. Thanks for patronizing. We'll see you guys next week.
Stop breaking the law, asshole!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.